The committee will come to order. When we broke for recess, we were under the five-minute rule. I now recognize Mr. Sensenbrenner for 5 minutes to question the witnesses.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm a veteran of impeachments. I've been named by the House as an impeachment manager in 4 impeachments, Clinton and 3 judges. That's more than anybody else in history. And one of the things in every impeachment, whether it's the ones that I was involved in or others that have come before the committee where I was not a manager, is a debate on what is a high crime and misdemeanor and how serious does that have to be in order for it to rise to a level of an impeachable offense. About 50 years ago, then Republican leader Gerald Ford made a comment that saying a high crime and misdemeanor is anything a majority of the House of Representatives deems it to be on any given day. I don't agree with that. You know, that sets either a very low bar or a non-existent bar. And it certainly would make the president serve at the pleasure of the House, which was not what the framers intended when they rejected the British form of parliamentary democracy, where the prime minister and the government could be overthrown by a mere vote of no confidence in the House of Commons. So I'm looking at what we're facing here. This whole inquiry was started out by a comment that President Trump made to President Zelensky in the July 25th call of, quote, "do me a favor," unquote. There are some who have said it's a quid pro quo. There are some who have implied that it's a quid pro quo. But both Trump and Zelensky have said it wasn't, and Zelensky has said there was no pressure on me, and the aid came through within 6 weeks after the phone call in question was made. Now, you can contrast that to where there was no impeachment inquiry to Vice President Biden when he was giving a speech and said, you know, I held up $1 billion worth of aid unless the prosecutor was fired within 6 hours. And son of a bleep, that's what happened. Now, you know, it seems to me that if you're looking for a quid pro quo and looking for something that was really over the top, it was not saying, do me a favor. It was saying, son of a bleep, that's what happened in 6 hours. Now, you know, the Republicans who were in charge of Congress at the time Biden made that comment, we did not tie the country up for 3 months and going on 4 now, wrapping everybody in this town around the axle rod. We continued attempting to do the public's business. That's not what's happening here. And I think the American public are getting a little bit sick and tired of impeachment, 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 when they know that less than a year from now, they will be able to determine whether Donald Trump stays in office or somebody else will be elected. And I take this responsibility extremely seriously. You know, it is an awesome and very grave responsibility, and it is not one that should be done lightly. It is not one that should be done quickly, and it is not one without examining all of the evidence, which is what was done in the Nixon impeachment and what was done largely by Kenneth Starr in the Clinton impeachment. Now, I'd like to ask you, Professor Turley, because your mind is the only one of the 4 of you up there that doesn't seem to have it made up before you walk into the door. Isn't there a difference between saying, quote, do me a favor, and, quote, son of a bleep, that's what happened in 6 hours' time?
Grammatically, yes. Constitutionally, it really depends on the context. I think your point is a good one in the sense that we have to determine from the transcript and hopefully from other witnesses whether this statement was part of an actual quid pro quo. I guess the threshold question is, if the president said, I'd like you to do these investigations, and by the way, I don't group them together. In my testimony, I distinguish between the request for investigations into 2016 from the investigation of the Bidens. But it is an issue of order, the magnitude of the of order constitutionally, if you ask, I'd like you to see you do this, as opposed to, I have a quid pro quo, you either do this or you don't get military aid.
Thank you.
The gentleman has expired. The gentlelady from Texas, Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for yielding. Professor Gerhardt said, if what we are talking about today is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable. I'm reminded of my time on the House Judiciary Committee during the 1990s impeachment and as well a number of federal judges. I was guided then not only by the facts, but by the Constitution and the duty to serve this nation. I believe, as we greet you today, that we are charged with a sober and somber responsibility. So, Professor Carlin, I'd like you to look at the intelligence volume where hundreds of documents are behind that in the Mueller report. Professor Carlin, you studied the record. Do you think it is, quote, wafer thin? And can you remark on the strength of the record before us?
Thanks. So obviously it's not wafer thin. And the strength of the record is not just in the the July 25th call. I think the way you need to ask about this is, how does it fit into the pattern of behavior by the president? Because what you're really doing is you're drawing inferences here. This is about circumstantial evidence as well as direct evidence. That is, you're trying to infer, did the president ask for a political favor? And I think this record supports the inference that he did.
What comparisons, Professor Carlin, can we make between kings that the framers were afraid of and the president's conduct today?
So kings could do no wrong because the king's word was law. And contrary to what President Trump has said, Article 2 does not give him the power to do anything he wants. And I'll just give you one example that shows you the difference between him and a king, which is the Constitution says there can be no titles of nobility. So while the president can name his son Baron, he can't make him a baron.
Thank you. The founding father, George Mason, asked, shall any man be above justice? And Alexander Hamilton wrote that high crimes and misdemeanors mean the abuse or violation of some public trust. As we move quickly, Professor Feldman, you have previously testified that the president has abused his power. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
What do you think is the most compelling evidence in this impeachment inquiry that would lead you to that?
The phone call itself of July 25th is extraordinarily clear to my mind in that we hear the president asking for a favor that's clearly of personal benefit rather than acting on behalf of the interests of the nation. And then further down the road, we have more evidence, which tends to give the context and to support the explanation for what happened.
Professor Carlin, how does such abuse affect our democratic systems?
Having foreign interference in our election means that we are less free. It is less we, the people, who are determining who's the next winner than it is a foreign government.
I think it is fair to say that the president's actions are unprecedented. But what also strikes me is how many Republicans and Democrats believe that his conduct was wrong. Let's listen
to... It is improper for the president of the United States...
Listen to the colonel.
It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
Professor Feldman, in light of the fact that the President asked for an investigation and then only when he was caught released the military aid, is there still a need for impeachment?
Yes, ma'am. Impeachment is complete when the President abuses his office, and he abuses his office by attempting to abuse his office. There's no distinction there between trying to do it and succeeding in doing it, and that's especially true if you only stop because you got caught.
Over 70% of the American people believe, as I said, what the president did was wrong. We have a solemn responsibility to address that, and as well our fidelity to our oath and our duty, reminded of the men and women who serve in the United States military. And I'm reminded of my three uncles who served in World War II. I can't imagine them being on the battlefield, needing arms and food. And the general says, do me a favor. We know that general would not say, do me a favor. And so in this instance, the American people deserve unfettered leadership, and it is our duty to fairly assess the facts and the Constitution. I yield back my time.
General Lady yields back. Mr. Chabot is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's pretty clear to me that no matter what questions we ask these four witnesses here today, and no matter what their answers are, that most, if not all, of the Democrats on this committee are going to vote to impeach President Trump. That's what their hardcore Trump-hating base wants, and they've wanted that since the president was elected 3 years ago. In fact, when Democrats took over the House, one of the first things that they did was introduce articles of impeachment against President Trump, and that was way before President Trump and the Ukrainian President Zelensky ever had their famous phone call, whether it was perfect or not.
Excuse me.
Now, today, we're undertaking a largely academic exercise instead of hearing from fact witnesses like Adam Schiff or Hunter Biden, but we're not being permitted to call those witnesses. It would seem that since Schiff, for example, misled the American people on multiple occasions, common sense and basic fairness would call for Schiff to be questioned about those things, but we can't. Mr. Chairman, back in 1998, when another president, Bill Clinton, was being considered for impeachment, you said, and I quote, "We must not overturn an election and impeach a president without an overwhelming consensus of the American people and their representatives in Congress." You also said, quote, "There must never be a narrowly voted impeachment or an impeachment substantially supported by one of the major political parties and largely opposed by the other." You said such an impeachment would lack legitimacy, would produce divisiveness and bitterness in our politics for years to come, and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institutions. That's what you said back then, Mr. Chairman. Well, what you said should never happen, that we should never do, is exactly what you're doing now, moving forward without a consensus and impeachment by one major party that's opposed by the other. And it's almost certain that it's going to result in the very divisiveness and bitterness that you so accurately warned us about back then. Mr. Chairman, a couple more quotes from a very wise Jerry Nadler from about two decades ago. Quote, "The last thing you want, it's almost illegitimate, is to have a party line impeachment. You shouldn't impeach the president unless it's a broad consensus of the American people." Those were wise words, Mr. Chairman, but you're not following them today. And finally, again, your words back then, "The issue in a potential impeachment is whether to overturn the results of a national election, the free expression of the popular will of the American people. That is an enormous responsibility and an extraordinary power. It is not one we should exercise lightly. It is certainly not one which should be exercised in a manner which either is or would be perceived by the American people to be unfair or partisan," unquote. Again, Mr. Chairman, those things that you warned against then are exactly what you and your Democratic colleagues are doing now. You're about to move forward with a totally party-line impeachment. That is clearly not a broad consensus of the American people. You're overturning the result of a national election, and there's no doubt that it will be perceived by at least half of the American people as an unfair and partisan effort. You seem bound and determined to move forward with this impeachment, and the American people deserve better. I get it. Democrats on this committee don't like this president. They don't like his policies. They don't like him as a person. They hate his tweets. They don't like the fact that the Mueller investigation was a flop. So now you're going to impeach him. Well, I got news for you. You may be able to twist enough arms in the House to impeach the president, but that effort's going to die in the Senate. the president's going to serve out his term in office and in all likelihood be reelected to a second term, probably with the help of this very impeachment charade that we're going through now. And while you're wasting so much of Congress's time and the American people's money on this impeachment, there are so many other important things that are going undone. Within this committee's own jurisdiction, we should be addressing the opioid epidemic. We could be working together to find a solution to our immigration and asylum challenges on our southern border. We could be protecting Americans from having their intellectual property and jobs stolen by Chinese companies. And we could be enhancing election security, just to name a few things. And Congress as a whole could be working on rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, providing additional tax relief to the nation's middle-class families, and providing additional security to our people here at home and abroad. Instead, here we are spinning our wheels once again on impeachment. What a waste. The American people deserve so much better. I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. Mr. Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I take no pleasure in the fact that we're here today. As a patriot who loves America, it pains me that the circumstances force us to undertake this grave and solemn obligation. Nonetheless, based simply on the publicly available evidence, it appears that President Trump pressured a foreign government to interfere in our elections by investigating his perceived chief political opponent. Today we are here to uphold our oaths to defend the Constitution of the United States by furthering our understanding whether the president's conduct is impeachable. It is entirely appropriate that we're examining our nation's history as it relates to presidential impeachment. The framers of the Constitution legitimately feared foreign interference in our nation's sovereignty, and they wanted to ensure that there would be a check and balance on the executive. We sit here with a duty to the founders to fulfill their wisdom in being a check on the executive. We, the People's House, are that check. Under our Constitution, the House can impeach a president for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Professor Feldman, you've discussed high crimes and misdemeanors, and the fact that the high refers to both crimes and misdemeanors. Can you just give us a little bit of a summary of what high crimes and misdemeanors are and how they're distinct from what Professor Turley said they were?
Yes, sir. High crimes and misdemeanors are actions of the president in office where he uses his office to advance his personal interests, potentially for personal gain, potentially to corrupt the electoral process, and potentially as well against the national security interests of the United States. I would add, sir, that the word high modifies both crimes and misdemeanors. The framers' world knew of both high crimes and high misdemeanors. And I believe that the definition that was posted earlier of misdemeanor was not the definition of high misdemeanor, which is a specific term understood by the framers and discussed in the Constitutional Convention, but only of the word misdemeanor. And that's an easy mistake to make, but the truth is that high misdemeanors were their own category of abuses of office, and those are the things that are impeachable.
Thank you, Professor. Professors Feldman, Carlin, and Gerhardt, you've all testified the president's conduct here implicates three categories of high crimes and misdemeanors: abuse of power, betrayal of the national interest, and corruption of elections. Is that right, Professor Carlin?
Yes, it is.
And Professor Feldman and Professor Gerhardt, do you agree?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Professor Carlin, you stated that the essence of an impeachable offense is the president's decision to sacrifice the national interest for his own private ends. Professor Feldman and Gerhardt, do you all also agree with that?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Based on the evidence you've seen, Professors Feldman, Carlin, and Gerhardt, has President Trump sacrificed the country's interest in favor of his own? Professor Carlin?
Yes, he has.
And is there a particular piece of evidence that most illuminates that?
I think what illuminates that most for me is the statement by Ambassador Sondland that he wanted simply the announcement of an investigation. And several other people said exactly the same thing. There's testimony by Ambassador Volker to this extent as well, that what he wanted was simply public information to damage Joe Biden. He didn't care whether at the end of the day Joe Biden was found guilty or exonerated.
And Professor Feldman, do you agree, or do you have a different or the same illuminating fact?
My emphasis would be on the fact that the president held up aid to an ally that's fighting a war in direct contravention of the unanimous recommendation of the national security community. That, to me, seems to have placed his own interests in personal advantage ahead of the interests of the nation.
And a bill passed by Congress, bipartisan.
Yes, sir.
Professor Gerhardt?
I agree with what my colleagues have said. I would add that I'm very concerned about the president's obstruction of Congress. obstruction of this inquiry, refusal to comply with a number of subpoenas, ordering many high-level officials in the government not to comply with subpoenas, and asking and ordering the entire executive branch not to cooperate with Congress. It's useful to remember the Constitution says the House has the sole power to impeach. The Constitution only uses the word sole twice, once with reference to the House in this area, once with reference to the Senate with respect to impeachment trials. Sole, means only. And this is your decision.
And let me get Professor Turley into this. Professor Turley, you're a self-described, self-anointed defender of Article I Congress guy. But you justify a position that says legally issued subpoenas by Congress enforcing its powers don't have to be complied with. It seems in this circumstance you're an Article II executive guy. You're talking about the Johnson impeachment is not very useful. That was maladministration. This is a criminal act. Thank you, professors, for helping us understand high crimes and misdemeanors. We, the people's representatives in the people's house, are heirs and custodians of the founders' vision of this country where the people are sovereign. We have a high responsibility and charged with the sole power to uphold our Constitution and defend our democracy, and we shall do that.
The gentleman's time has expired. Mr. Gohmert.
Thank you. I'm afraid this hearing is indicative of the indecency to which we've come when instead of the Committee of Jurisdiction bringing in fact witnesses to get to the bottom of what happened, and not even having time to review the report, which, as Professor Turley indicated, is wafer thin when compared to the 36 boxes of documents that were delivered to the last impeachment group. But then to start this hearing with the chairman of the committee saying that the facts are undisputed, the only thing that is disputed more than the facts in this case is the statement that the facts are undisputed. They are absolutely disputed, and the evidence is a bunch of hearsay on hearsay that if anybody here had tried cases before, of enough magnitude, you would know you can't rely on hearsay, but we have experts who know better than the accumulated experience of the ages. So here we are, and I would submit we need some factual witnesses. We do not need to receive a report that we don't have a chance to read before this hearing. We need a chance to bring in actual fact witnesses. And there are a couple I can name that are critical to us getting to the bottom. They work for the National Security Council, Abigail Grace, Sean Miskow. They were involved in the U.S.-Ukraine affairs. And they worked with Vice President Biden on different matters involving the Ukraine. They worked with Brennan and Masters. They have absolutely critical information about certain Ukrainians' involvement in our U.S. election. Their relationships with the witnesses who went before the Intel Committee and others involved in these allegations make them the most critical witnesses in this entire investigation. And their records, including their emails or text messages, their flash drives or computers, have information that will bring this effort to remove the president to a screeching halt. So we have an article here from October 11th. Kerry Pickett points out that House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff recruited two former National Security Council aides who worked alongside the CIA whistleblower at the NSC during the Obama and Trump administrations. Abigail Grace, who worked at the NSC until 2018, was hired in February, while Sean Miskow, an NSC aide until 2017, joined Schiff's committee in August, the same month the whistleblower submitted his complaint. And goes on to point out that Grace was hired to help Schiff's committee investigate the Trump White House. That month, Trump accused Schiff of stealing people who were working at the White House. And Chairman Schiff said, if the president's worried about our hiring any former administration people, maybe should work on being a better employer. No, he should have fired everybody, just like Bill Clinton did, all the U.S. attorneys on the same day. That would have saved us a lot of what's going on here. So anyway, we need those two witnesses. They're critical. And then we also need someone who is a CIA detail aide of the Ukraine NSC desk. State Department FOIA shows that he was at an Italy state luncheon. There's Italy ramifications in the last elections. He speaks Arabic and Russian, reported directly to Charles Kupchin, who's a friend of the Clinton's aide, said Blumenthal. He did policy work for Ukraine corruption, close continuous contact with the FBI state Ukrainian officials, had a collateral duty to support Vice President Biden. It was, and Biden was Obama's point man on Ukraine. He's associated with DNC operative Ali Chalupa, who we also need. Met with her November 9, 2015 with Ukrainian delegation. And there's all kinds of reasons we need these three witnesses. And I would ask, pursuant to Section 4, House Resolution 660, ask our chairman to, our ranking member, to submit the request for these three witnesses, because we're not having a factual hearing until we have these people that are at the bottom of every fact of this investigation.
Gentlemen,
I yield back. Thanks for bringing down the gavel hard. That was nice.
Gentleman yields back. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The President has regularly and recently solicited foreign interference in our upcoming elections. Professor Turley warns that this is an impulse buy moment and suggests that the House should pause. Professor Carlin, do you agree with Professor Turley?
No. If you conclude that, as I think the evidence to this point shows, that the President is soliciting foreign involvement in our election, you need to act now to prevent foreign interference in the next election like the one we had in the past.
Thank you. Professor Carlin, in 30 seconds or less, tell us why you believe the President's misconduct was an abuse of power so egregious that it merits the drastic remedy of impeachment.
Because he invited the Russians, who are our longtime adversaries, into the process the last time around, because he has invited the Ukrainians into the process, and because he suggested he would like the Chinese to come into the process as well.
Thank you very much. One of the framers of our Constitution, Edmund Randolph, who at one time was mayor of Williamsburg, Virginia, warned us that, quote, the executive will have great opportunities of abusing his power, end quote. Professor Feldman, people like Mayor Randolph rebelled because of the tyranny of a king. Why were the framers so careful to avoid the potential for a president to become so tyrannical and abusive? And what did they do to protect against it?
The framers believed very strongly that the people were the king, the people were sovereign. And that meant that the president worked for somebody, he worked for the people. They knew that a president who couldn't be checked, who could not be supervised by his own Justice Department, and who could not be supervised by Congress and could not be impeached, would effectively be above the law and then would use his power to get himself reelected. And that's why they created the impeachment remedy.
Thank you, Professor Feldman. I now want to discuss how the framers' concerns about abuse of power relate to President Trump's misconduct. On July 25th, President Trump said to President Zelensky, quote, I would like you to do us a favor, though. Professor Feldman, when President Trump made use of the words favor, though, do you believe that the president was benignly asking for a favor, and how is the answer to that question relevant to whether the president abused his power?
It's relevant, sir, because there's nothing wrong with someone asking for a favor in the interest of the United States of America. The problem is for the president to use his office to solicit or demand a favor for his personal benefit. And the evidence strongly suggests that given the power of the president and given the incentives that the president created for Ukraine to comply with his request, that the president was seeking to serve his own personal benefit and his own personal interest. That's the definition of corruption under the Constitution.
Other witnesses have also testified that it was their impression that when President Trump said, I would like you to do us a favor, though, that he was actually making a demand and not a request. Professor Feldman, how does Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's testimony that the president's statement was a demand because of the power disparity between the two countries relate back to our framers' concerns about the president's abuse of power?
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's observation states very clearly that you have to understand that the President of the United States has so much more power than the President of Ukraine, that when the President uses the word favor, the reality is that he's applying tremendous pressure, the pressure of the power of the United States. And that relates to the constitutional abuse of office. If someone other than the President of the United States asked the President of Ukraine to do a favor, the President of Ukraine could say no. When the President of the United States uses the office of the presidency to ask for a favor, there's simply no way for the President of Ukraine to refuse.
Thank you. We've also heard testimony that the President withheld a White House meeting and military aid in order to further pressure Ukraine to announce investigations of Vice President Biden and the 2016 election. Professor Carlin, is that why your testimony concluded that the President abused his power?
I thought the president abused his power by asking for a criminal investigation of a United States citizen for political ends, regardless of everything else. It's not icing on the cake. It's what you would call an aggravating circumstance that there was need here.
All right. Thank you. A president holding an American ally over a barrel to extract personal favors is deeply troubling. This is not a impulse buy moment, it's a break the glass moment, and impeachment is the only appropriate remedy, and with that, I will yield back.
The gentleman yields back. Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before Speaker Pelosi announced the impeachment inquiry 10 weeks ago on September 24th, before the call between President Trump and President Zelensky on July 25th, before the Mueller hearing in front of this committee on July 24th, before all that, 16 of them had already voted to move forward on impeachment. 16 Democrats on the Judiciary Committee had already voted to move forward on impeachment, yet today we're talking about whether the positions they've already taken are constitutional. Seems a little backward to me. I mean, we can't get agreement. I mean, we got four Democrats or four people who voted for Clinton, and they can't agree. Yet today we're talking about the Constitution. Now, Professor Turley, you've been great today. But I think you were wrong on one thing. You said this is a fast impeachment. I would argue it's not a fast impeachment. It's a predetermined impeachment. Predetermined impeachment done in the most unfair partisan fashion we have ever seen. No subpoena power for Republicans. Depositions done in secret, in the bunker, in the basement of the Capitol. 17 people come in for those depositions. No one can be in there except a handful of folks that Adam Schiff allowed in those depositions. Chairman Schiff prevented witnesses from answering Republican questions. Every Democrat question got answered. Not every Republican question. Democrats denied Republicans the witnesses we wanted in the open hearings that took place 3 weeks ago. And, of course, Democrats promised us the whistleblower would testify and then change their mind. And they changed their mind. Why? Because the whole world discovered that Adam Schiff's staff had talked to the whistleblower, coordinated with the whistleblower. The whistleblower with no firsthand knowledge, bias against the president, who worked with Joe Biden, whose lawyer in January of 17 said the impeachment process starts then. That's the unfair process we've been through. And the reason it's been unfair, let me just cut to the chase. The reason it's been unfair is because the facts aren't on their side. The facts are on the president's side. Four key facts will not change, have not changed, will never change. We have the transcript. There was no quid pro quo in the transcript. The two guys on the call, President Trump and President Zelensky, both said no pressure, no pushing, no quid pro quo. The Ukrainians, third, didn't know that the aid was held up at the time of the phone call. And fourth, and most important, the Ukrainians never started, never promised to start, and never announced an investigation in the time that the aid was paused. Never once. But you know what did happen in those 55 days that the aid was paused? There were five key meetings between President Zelensky and senior officials in our government. Five key meetings. We had the call on July 25th, the very next day, July 26th. We had Ambassador Volker, Taylor, and Sondland meet with President Zelensky in Kyiv. We then had Ambassador Bolton, end of August, meet with President Zelensky. We then had the Vice President meet with President Zelensky on September 1st, and we had two senators, Republican and, more importantly, Democrat Senator Murphy with Republican Senator Johnson meet with President Zelensky on September 5th. None of those five meetings was aid ever discussed in exchange for an announcement of an investigation into anybody. Not one of them. And you would think the last two, after the Ukrainians did know the aid was being held, you would think it would come up then. Particularly the one where you got Senator Murphy, the Democrat, there talking about it. Never came up. The facts are on the president's side. But we got an unfair process because they don't have the facts. We got an unfair process, most importantly. And this gets to something else you said, Mr. Turley. And this is scary. How mad the country... I mean, that was so well said. This is scary. The Democrats have never accepted the will of the American people. To Mr. Turley's point, 17 days ago, the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives called the President of the United States an imposter. The guy 63 million Americans voted for, who won an Electoral College landslide, the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives called that individual an imposter. That is not healthy for our country. This is not healthy. The facts are the facts. They are on the president's side. That's what we need to focus on, not some constitutional hearing at the end of the process when you guys have already determined where you're going to go. With that, I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. Mr. Deutsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this month we commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. My late father, Bernard Deutsch, then Staff Sergeant Bernard Deutsch, received a Purple Heart fighting in the frigid Ardennes. He gave blood among tens of thousands of Americans who were casualties. They served under officers and a commander-in-chief who were not fighting a war for their own personal benefit. They put country first. They made the same solemn promise that members of Congress and the President of the United States make, to always put national interest above their own personal interest. The evidence shows that the President broke that promise. The Constitution gives the President enormous power, but it also imposes a remedy, impeachment, when those powers are abused. In July, President Trump said, and I quote, "I have an Article 2 where I have the right to do whatever I want as president," close quote. Professor Feldman, the president has broad powers under the Constitution, including in foreign policy. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
And do those powers mean that the president can do, as he said, whatever he wants as president? Can he abuse the powers that the Constitution gives him?
He may not. If the president uses the powers that he's given for personal gain or to corrupt an election, or against the national security interest of the United States, he may be impeached for a high crime and misdemeanor.
Is using his power to pressure Ukraine to interfere in U.S. elections an abuse of that power?
Yes, sir.
Professor Gerhardt, how would the framers of the Constitution have viewed a president asking for election interference from a foreign leader?
It's practically impossible to know exactly what the framers would think, but it's not hard to imagine how the Constitution deals with it. That's their legacy to us. And under the Constitution, it's plainly an abuse of power. It's a rather horrifying abuse of power.
And Professor Carlin, we've heard witnesses over the past several weeks testify about their concerns when the president used his foreign policy powers for political gain. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was shocked. He couldn't believe what he heard on the phone call. NSC advisor Hill realized that a political errand was diverging from efforts to protect our national security policy. And Ambassador Taylor thought it was crazy to withhold security assistance for help on a political campaign. And Professor Carlin, these concerns aren't mere differences over policy, are they?
No, they go to the foundation, the very foundation of our democracy.
And offering to exchange a White House meeting and hundreds of millions of dollars in security assistance for help with his reelection, that can't be part of our nation's foreign policy, can it?
No, it's the essence of doing something for personal reasons rather than for political reasons. And if I could just say one thing about this very briefly, which is maybe when he was first running for president, he had never been anything other than a reality TV show. That was his public life. Maybe then he could think, Russia, if you're listening, is an okay thing to do. But by the time he asked the Ukraine, if you're listening, could you help me out with my reelection? He has to have known that that was not something consistent with his oath of office.
Mr. Chairman, our founders granted the President of the United States enormous powers. But at the same time, what we've been reminded of today, they worry that these powers could be abused by a corrupt president. The evidence of abuse of power in this inquiry proved that our founders were right to be worried. Yes, yes, the president has the power to direct America's foreign policy. But no, he cannot use that power to cheat in our elections. Remember, and I ask all of my colleagues to remember, the Constitution grants the president his power through the American people. The president's source of power is a democratic election. It is the American people, the voters, who trusted him to look out for them. We trusted him to look out for the country. But instead, President Trump looked out for himself and helping himself get reelected. He abused the power that we trusted him with for personal and political gain. The founders worried about just this type of abuse of power, and they provided one way for Congress to respond, and that's the power of impeachment. I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. Mr. Buck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Turley, I want to direct these first few questions to you. The other three witnesses have identified this amorphous standard for impeaching a president. They've said that if a president abuses his power for personal or political gain, it's impeachable conduct. You agree with me?
Not the way it's been stated. In fact, there's so many different standards.
I got a long ways to go here.
There's been so many different standards. One of them was attempting to abuse office.
Okay.
I'm not even sure how to recognize that, let alone define it.
So let me go with a few examples and see if you agree with me. Lyndon Johnson directed the Central Intelligence Agency to place a spy in Barry Goldwater's campaign. That spy got advance copies of speeches and other strategy, delivered that to the Johnson campaign. Would that be impeachable conduct, according to the other panelists?
Oh, well, it sweeps pretty broadly, so I assume so.
How about when President Johnson put a wiretap on Goldwater's campaign plane? Would that be for political benefit?
Well, I can't exclude anything under that definition.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go with a few other presidents. We'll see where we go. Congressman Deutsch just informed us that FDR put country first. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he was president, directed the IRS to conduct audits of his political enemies, namely Huey Long, William Randolph Hearst, Hamilton Fish, Father Coughlin. Would that be an abuse of power for political benefit, according to the other panelists? Would that be impeachable conduct?
I think it all would be subsumed into it.
How about when President Kennedy directed his brother, Robert Kennedy, to deport one of his mistresses as an East German spy? Would that qualify as impeachable conduct?
Once again, I can't exclude it.
And how about when he directed the FBI to use wiretaps on congressional staffers who opposed him politically? Would that be impeachable conduct?
It would seem to be falling within it.
And let's go to Barack Obama. When Barack Obama directed or made a finding that the Senate was in recess and appointed people to the National Labor Relations Board and lost 9-0, Ruth Bader Ginsburg voted against the president on this issue. Would that be an abuse of power?
I'm afraid you have to direct it to others, but I don't see any exclusions under their definition.
Okay, and how about when the president directed his national security advisor and the secretary of state to lie to the American people about whether the ambassador to Libya was murdered as a result of a video or was murdered as a result of a terrorist act? Would that be an abuse of power for political benefit 17 days before the next election?
Well, not according to my definition, but the others will have to respond to their own.
Well, you've heard their definition. You can apply those facts to their definition.
I have a hard time excluding anything out of...
How about when Abraham Lincoln arrested legislators in Maryland so that they wouldn't convene to secede from the Union? And Virginia already had seceded, so it would have placed Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, in the middle of the rebellion. Would that have been an abuse of power for political benefit?
Well, it could be under that definition.
And you mentioned George Washington a little while ago as perhaps having met the standard of impeachment for your other panelists. In fact, let me ask you something, Professor Turley. Can you name a single president in the history of the United States, save President Harrison, who died 32 days after his inauguration, that would not have met the standard of impeachment for our friends here?
I would hope to God James Madison would escape. Otherwise, a lifetime of academic work would be shredded. I can't exclude many of these acts.
Isn't what you and I and many others are afraid of is that the standard that your friends to the right of you, and not politically, but to the right of you sitting in there, that your friends have decided that the bar is so low that when we have a Democrat president in office and a Republican House and a Republican Senate, we're going to be going through this whole scenario again in a way that really puts the country at risk.
Thank you. Well, when your graphic says in your ABCs that your B is betrayal of national interest, I would simply ask, do you really want that to be your standard?
Now, isn't the difference, Professor Turley, that some people live in an ivory tower and some people live in a swamp? And those of us that are in the swamp are doing our very best for the American people,
well, actually,
but it's not pretty.
Actually, I live in an ivory tower in a swamp because I'm at GW, but and it's not so bad.
I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. Ms. Bass.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank the witnesses, and I don't believe that People's House is a swamp. President Nixon was impeached for abuse of power because his conduct was, quote, undertaken for his personal political advantage and not in furtherance of any valid national policy objective. President Gerhardt, why was it significant that President Nixon acted for his personal political advantage and not in furtherance of any valid national policy objective?
It's primarily significant because in acting for his own personal benefit and not for the benefit of the country, he has crossed a line. The line here is very clear, and it becomes abuse of power when somebody's using the special authorities of their office for their own personal benefit and not the benefit of the country.
So can the same be said of President Trump?
It could be, yes. Yes.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm struck by the parallels because one of the things that Nixon did was he launched tax investigations of his political opponents. Here the evidence shows Trump tried to launch a criminal investigation of his political opponent by a foreign government. We have heard evidence suggesting that President Trump did this for his own personal gain and not for any national policy interest. Although President Trump claims that he withheld the aid because of concerns about corruption, I do believe that we have example of the evidence of the truth.
Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing.
Professor Feldman, what would the framers have thought of a president who only cares about the, quote, big stuff that benefits him?
The framers were extremely worried about a president who served only his own interests or the interests of foreign powers. That was their most serious concern when they designed the remedy of impeachment.
So the evidence also suggests that President Trump didn't even care if the investigation actually happened. What he really cared about was the public announcement of the investigation. So, Professor Carlin, how do we analyze these facts in the context of abuse of power?
Well, I think that to have a president ask for the investigation of his political opponents is an archetype of the abuse of power. And, you know, Mr. Buck mentioned past examples of this. And to say that those weren't impeachable, I think, is a big mistake. If a president wiretaps his opponents, that's a federal crime now. I don't know whether before the Wiretap Act of 1968 it was. But if a president wiretapped his opponents today, that would be impeachable conduct.
I also serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and I understand how significant it is to foreign leaders to meet with our presidents. To attend a meeting in the Oval Office is very significant. President Zelensky is a newly elected head of state in a fledgling democracy. His country is at war with his neighbor. Russia invaded and is occupying his country's territory. He needed the military resources to defend his country. He needed the diplomatic recognition of the American president. And he was prepared to do whatever the president demanded. Many years ago, I worked in the nation's largest trauma unit as a PA, a physician assistant. I saw people at their worst in severe pain after accidents or acts of violence. Patients I took care of were desperate and afraid and had to wait 5 to 8 hours to be seen. Can you imagine for 1 minute if I had told my patients, look, I can move you up in line and take care of your pain, but I do need a favor from you, though. My patients were in pain and they were desperate, and they would have agreed to do anything I asked. This would have been such an abuse of my position because of the power dynamic. I had the power to relieve my patients from experiencing pain. It's fundamentally wrong and in many cases illegal for us to use power to take advantage of those in crisis, especially a president, especially when lives are at stake. I yield back.
The gentlelady yields back. Mr. Ratcliffe.
Thank the chairman. Professor Turley, I'd like to start where you started, because you said something that I think bears repeating. You said, I'm not a supporter of President Trump. I voted against him in 2016, and I have previously voted for Presidents Clinton and Obama. But despite your political preferences and persuasions, you reached this conclusion. The current legal case for impeachment is not just woefully inadequate, but in some respects dangerous as the basis for impeachment of an American president. So let me start by commending you for being the kind of example of what hopefully everyone on this committee will do as we approach the task that we have of determining whether or not there were any impeachable offenses here. One of the problems that you've articulated as leading you to the conclusion of calling this the, should it proceed, the shortest impeachment proceeding with the thinnest evidentiary record and the narrowest grounds ever attempted to impeach a president, is the fact that there has been this ever-changing, constantly evolving, moving target of accusations, if you will. The July 25th phone call started out as an alleged quid pro quo and briefly became an extortion scheme, a bribery scheme. I think it's back to quid pro quo. Now, besides pointing out that both Speaker Pelosi and Chairman Schiff waited until almost every witness had been deposed before they even started to use the term bribery, I think you've clearly articulated why you think the definitions that they have used publicly are flawed, if not unconstitutional, both in the 18th century or in the 21st century. But would you agree with me that bribery under any valid definition requires that a specific quid pro quo be proven?
Yes, more importantly, the Supreme Court is focused on that issue, as well as what is the definition of a quid pro quo.
So if military aid or security assistance is part of that quid pro quo, where in the July 25th transcript does President Trump ever suggest that he intends to withhold military aid for any reason?
He doesn't. And that's the reason we keep on hearing the words circumstantial and inferential. And that's what is so concerning, is that those would be appropriate terms. It's not that you can't have a circumstantial case. Those would be appropriate terms if these were unknowable facts. But the problem is that you have so many witnesses that have not been subpoenaed, so many witnesses that we've not heard from.
Right. So if it's not in the transcript, then it's got to come from witness testimony, and I assume you've reviewed all the witness testimony. So you know that no witness has testified that they either heard President Trump or were told by President Trump to withhold military aid for any reason, correct?
Correct.
So let me turn to the issue of obstruction of justice quickly. I think you assumed, as I did, that when Democrats have been talking about obstruction, it was specifically related to the Ukraine issue. And I know you've talked about that a lot today. You've clearly stated that you think that President Trump had no corrupt intent on page 39 of your report. You said something else I think that bears repeating today. You were highlighting the fact that the Democrats appear to be taking the position that if a president seeks judicial review over executive branch testimony or documents subpoenaed by Congress, that rather than letting the courts be the arbiter, Congress can simply impeach the president for obstruction based on that. Did I hear you say that if we were to proceed on that basis, that that would be an abuse of power?
I did, and let me be very clear about this. I don't disagree with my colleagues that nothing in the Constitution says you have to go to a court or wait for a court. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if you want a well-based, a legitimate impeachment case, to set this abbreviated schedule, demand documents, and then impeach because they haven't been turned over when the president goes to a court, I think that is an abuse of power. That's not what happened in Nixon. And in fact, the ultimate decision in Nixon was that there are legitimate executive privilege claims that could be raised. And some of them deal with the type of aides involved in this case, like a national security advisor, like a White House counsel. And so the concern here is not that there is that you can't ever impeach a president unless you go to court. It's just that you shouldn't when you have time to do it.
So if I were to summarize your testimony, no bribery, no extortion, no obstruction of justice, no abuse of power. Is that fair?
Not on this record.
The gentleman's time has expired. Mr. Richmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me just pick up where we left off. And I'm going to start, Mr. Turley, with your words. And it's from October 23rd, your opinion piece in the Hill. You said that, as I have said before, there is no question that the use of public office for personal gain is an impeachable offense, including the withholding of military aid in exchange for the investigation of a political opponent. You just have to prove it happened. If you can establish intent to use public office for personal gain, you have a viable, impeachable offense. We've heard today that a president abuses his power when he uses his official power for his own personal interest rather than the interest of our country. I'd like to spend more time on that because I'm really struck by one of the things that was at stake here. $400 million of taxpayer dollars. President Nixon leveraged the powers of his office to investigate political rivals. But here, the evidence shows that President Trump also leveraged taxpayer dollars to get Ukraine to announce sham investigations of President Trump's political rivals. That taxpayer money was meant to help Ukraine defend itself and in turn defend United States interests from Russian aggression. The money had been appropriated by Congress and certified by the Department of Defense. Multiple witnesses confirmed that there was unanimous support for the military aid to Ukraine. Can we listen to that, please?
From what you witnessed, did anybody in the national security community support withholding the assistance?
No.
I never heard anyone advocate for holding the aid.
And the entire interagency supported the continuation of the security assistance, isn't that right?
That is correct.
I and others sat in astonishment. The Ukrainians were fighting Russians and counted on not only the training and weapons, but also the assurance of U.S. support.
Professor Feldman, you've stated that the president's demand to the president of Ukraine constituted an abuse of power. How does the president's decision to withhold military aid affect your analysis?
It means that it wasn't just an abuse of power because the president was serving his own personal interests, but also an abuse of power insofar as the president was putting American national security interests behind his own personal interests. So it brought together two important aspects of the abuse of power, self-gain and undercutting our national security interests.
The evidence points to President Trump using military aid for his personal benefit, not for the benefit of any official U.S. policy. Professor Carlin, how would the framers have interpreted that?
Well, I can't speak for the framers themselves, obviously. My view is that they would say that the president's authority to use foreign aid, and they probably couldn't have imagined we even were giving foreign aid because we were a tiny poor country then, so it's a little hard to translate that. But what they would have said is a president who doesn't think first about the security of the United States is not doing what his oath requires him to do, which was faithfully execute the laws, hear a law appropriating money, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Thank you. And let's go back to a segment of Mr. Turley's quote, that if you can establish intent to use public office for personal gain, you have a viable, impeachable offense. Mr. Feldman, do we meet that criteria here?
In my view, the evidence does meet that criteria, and that's the judgment that you should be making.
Ms. Carlin?
Yes, and one question I would just have for the minority members of the committee is, if you were convinced that the president held up the aid because he thought it would help his reelection, would you vote to impeach him? Because I think that's really the question that everyone on this committee should be asking. And if they conclude yes, then they should vote to impeach.
Mr. Gerhardt.
Yes, I agree. And one thing I would add is that much talk has been made here about the term bribery in court decisions that with respect to bribery. It's your job, it's the House's job to define bribery, not the courts. You follow your judgment on that.
I want to thank the witnesses, all of the witnesses, for coming and testifying today. This is not an easy decision. It's not a comfortable decision, but it's one that's necessary. We all take an oath to protect the Constitution. Our military men and women go and put their lives on the line for the Constitution, and we have an obligation to follow the Constitution, whether it's convenient or easy. Thank you, and I yield back the balance. The
gentleman yields back. Ms. Roby?
Very quickly, Professor Turley, would you like to respond?
yes, I would. First of all, what was said in that column is exactly what I've said in my testimony. The problem is not that abuse of power can never be an impeachable offense. You just have to prove it, and you haven't. It's not enough to say, I infer this was the purpose. I infer that this is what was intended, when you're not actually subpoenaing people with direct knowledge, and instead you're saying we must vote in this rocket docket of an impeachment.
So this leads to my statement that I'd like to make. Of course, the United States House of Representatives has initiated impeachment inquiries against the President of the United States only three times in our nation's history prior to this one. Those impeachment inquiries were done in this committee, the Judiciary Committee, which has jurisdiction over impeachment matters. Here, in 2019, under this inquiry, fact witnesses that have been called were in front of the Intelligence Committee. We have been given no indication that this committee will conduct substantive hearings with fact witnesses. As a member serving on the Judiciary Committee, I can say that the process in which we are participating is insufficient, unprecedented, and grossly inadequate. Sitting before us is a panel of witnesses containing four distinguished law professors from some of our country's finest educational institutions. I do not doubt that each of you are extremely well-versed in the subject of constitutional law. And yes, there is precedent for similar panels in the aforementioned history, but only after specific charges have been made known and the underlying facts presented in full due to an exhaustive investigation. However, I don't understand why we are holding this hearing at this time with these witnesses. My colleagues on the other side of the aisle have admitted they don't know what articles of impeachment they will consider. How does anyone expect a panel of law professors to weigh in on the legal grounds for impeachment charges prior to even knowing what the charges brought by this committee are going to be? Some of my Democrat colleagues have stated over and over that impeachment should be a nonpartisan process, and I agree. One of my colleagues in the Democratic Party stated, and I quote, impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there is something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country. My Democratic colleagues have stated numerous times that they are on a truth-seeking and fact-finding mission. Another one of my Democratic colleagues said, and I quote, we have a responsibility to consider the facts that emerge squarely and with the best interests of our country, not our party, in our hearts. These type of historic proceedings, regardless of political beliefs, ought to be about fact-finding and truth-seeking, but that is not what this has turned out to be. Again, no disrespect to these witnesses, but for all I know, this is the only hearing that we will have, and none of them are fact witnesses. My colleagues are saying one thing and doing something completely different. No member of Congress can look their constituents in the eye and say this is a comprehensive, fact-finding, truth-seeking mission. Ranking Member Collins and members of the minority on this committee have written 6 letters over the past month to Chairman Nadler asking for procedural fairness, for all the underlying evidence to be transmitted to the Judiciary Committee, to expand the number of witnesses and have an even more bipartisan panel here today, and for clarity on today's impeachment proceedings since we haven't received evidence to review. The minority has yet to receive a response to these letters. Right here today is another very clear example for all Americans to truly understand the ongoing lack of transparency and openness with these proceedings. The witness list for this hearing was not released until late Monday afternoon. Opening statements from the witnesses today were not distributed until late last night. And the Intelligence Committee's finalized report has yet to be presented to this committee. You hear from those in the majority that process is a Republican talking point, when in reality it is an American talking point. Process is essential to the institution. A thoughtful, meaningful process of this magnitude with such great implications should be demanded by the American people. With that, I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. Mr. Jeffries.
I did not serve in the military, but my 81-year-old father did. He was an Air Force veteran stationed in Germany during the height of the Cold War in the late 1950s. He was a teenager from inner city Newark, a stranger in a foreign land, serving on the western side of the Berlin Wall. My dad proudly wore the uniform because he swore an oath to the Constitution and believed in American democracy. I believe in American democracy. We remain the last best hope on earth. It is in that spirit that we proceed today. Professor Carlin, in America, we believe in free and fair elections. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
But authoritarian regimes do not. Is that right?
That's correct.
Thomas Jefferson once wrote, well, John Adams once wrote to Thomas Jefferson on December 6, 1787, and stated, "You are apprehensive of foreign interference, intrigue, influence. So am I. But as often as elections happen, the danger of foreign influence recurs." Professor Carlin, how important was the concept of free and fair elections to the framers of the Constitution?
Honestly, it was less important to them than it's become in our Constitution since then. And if you'll remember, one of the things that turned me into a lawyer was seeing Barbara Jordan, who was the first female lawyer I'd ever seen in practice, say on the committee that we, the people, didn't include people like her in 1789, but through a process of amendment, we have done that. And so elections are more important to us today as a constitutional matter than they were even to the framers.
And is it fair to say that an election cannot be reasonably characterized as free and fair if it's manipulated by foreign interference?
That's correct.
And the framers of the Constitution were generally and deeply concerned with the threat of foreign interference in the domestic affairs of the United States, true?
Yes.
And why were they so deeply concerned?
Because foreign nations don't have our interests at heart. They have their interests at heart.
And would the framers find it acceptable for an American president to pressure a foreign government to help him win an election?
I think they'd find it unacceptable for a president to ask a foreign government to help him, whether they put pressure on him or not.
Direct evidence shows that on a July 25th phone call, the president uttered 5 words, "Do us a favor, though." He pressured the Ukrainian government to target an American citizen for political gain, and at the same time, simultaneously withheld $391 million in military aid. Now, Ambassador Bill Taylor, West Point graduate, Vietnam War hero, Republican-appointed diplomat, discussed this issue of military aid. Here is a clip of his testimony.
Again, our holding up of security systems that would go to a country that is fighting aggression from Russia for no good policy reason, no good substantive reason, no good national security reason is wrong.
To the extent the military aid was being withheld as part of an effort to solicit foreign interference in the 2020 election, is that behavior impeachable?
Yes, it is. And if I could go back to one of the words you read, when the president said, do us a favor, he was using the royal we there. It wasn't a favor for the United States. He should have said, do me a favor, because only kings say us when they mean me.
And is it correct that an abuse of power that strikes at the heart of our democracy falls squarely within the definition of a high crime and misdemeanor?
Yes, it does.
Some of my colleagues have suggested that impeachment would overturn the will of the people. The American people expressed their will in November of 2018. The will of the people elected a new majority. The will of the people elected a house that would not function as a wholly owned subsidiary of this administration. The will of the people elected a house that understands we are a separate and co-equal branch of government. The will of the people elected a house that understands we have a constitutional responsibility to serve as a check and balance on an out-of-control executive branch. The president abused his power and must be held accountable. No one is above the law. America must remain the last best hope on earth. I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. Mr. Gates.
The will of the American people also elected Donald Trump to be the president of the United States in the 2016 election, and there's one party that can't seem to get over it. Now, we understand the fact that in 2018 you took the House of Representatives, and we haven't spent our time during your tenure in power trying to remove the Speaker of the House, trying to delegitimize your ability to govern. Frankly, we'd love to govern with you. We'd love to pass USMCA. We'd love to put out a helping hand to our seniors and lower prescription drug prices. It's the will of the people you ignore when you continue down this terrible road of impeachment. Professor Gerhardt, you gave money to Barack Obama, right?
My family did, yes.
Four times?
That sounds about right. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I have a series of unanimous consent requests relating to Professor Feldman's work. The first, Noah Feldman, Trump's wiretap tweets raise risk of impeachment.
Gentlemen will suspend. We'll take that time off. Has the gentleman submitted? Have we seen those that material?
We can provide it to you, as is typical
we'll
for unanimous.
And we'll consider the unanimous consent request later after we review
very
the
well.
Material.
Very well. Thank you.
The gentleman may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Feldman wrote articles entitled, Trump's wiretap tweets raise risk of impeachment. He then wrote, Mar-a-Lago ad belongs in impeachment file. And then Mr. Jake Flanagan wrote in Quartz, a Harvard law professor thinks Trump could be impeached over fake news accusations. My question, Professor Feldman, is since you seem to believe that the basis for impeachment is even broader than the basis that my Democrat colleagues have laid forward, do you believe you're outside of the political mainstream on the question of impeachment?
I believe that impeachment is warranted whenever the president abuses his power for personal benefit or to corrupt the democratic process.
Did you write an article entitled, It's Hard to Take Impeachment Seriously Now?
Yes, I did write that article.
And in that article, since
like
the 2018 midterm election, House Democrats have made it painfully clear that discussing impeachment is primarily or even exclusively a tool to weaken President Trump's chances in 2020. Did you write those words?
Until this call on July 25th, I was an impeachment skeptic.
I appreciate your testimony. Professor Carlin, you gave $1,000 to Elizabeth Warren, right?
I believe so.
You gave $1,200 to Barack Obama?
I have no reason to question that.
And you gave $2,000 to Hillary Clinton?
That's correct.
Why so much more for Hillary than the other two?
Because I've been giving a lot of money to charity recently because of all of the poor people in the United States.
Well, those aren't the only folks you've been given to. Now, have you ever been on a podcast called Versus Trump?
I think I was on a live panel that the people who ran the podcast called Versus Trump.
On that, do you remember saying the following? Liberals tend to cluster more. Conservatives, especially very conservative people, tend to spread out more. Perhaps because they don't even want to be around themselves. Did you say that?
Yes, I did.
Do you understand how that reflects contempt on people who are conservative?
No, what I was talking about there was the natural tendency, if you put the quote in context, the natural tendency of a compactness requirement to favor a party whose voters are more spread out.
Well,
and I do not have contempt
for conservatives.
Hold on,
I'm very limited on time, Professor. And so I just have to say, when you talk about how liberals want to be around each other and cluster, and conservatives don't want to be around each other and so they have to spread out, it makes people, you may not see this from, you know, like the ivory towers of your law school, but it makes actual people in this country feel like, you don't get to interrupt me on this time. Now, let me also suggest that when you invoke the president's son's name here, when you try to make a little joke out of referencing Barron Trump, that does not lend credibility to your argument. It makes you look mean. It makes you look like you're attacking someone's family, the minor child of the president of the United States. So let's see if we can get into the facts. To all of the witnesses, if you have personal knowledge of a single material fact in the Schiff report, please raise your hand. And let the record reflect. No personal knowledge of a single fact. And you know what? That continues on the tradition that we saw from Adam Schiff, where Ambassador Taylor could not identify an impeachable offense. Mr. Kent never met with the president. Fiona Hill never heard the president reference anything regarding military aid. Mr. Hale was unaware of any nefarious activity with aid. Colonel Vindman even rejected the new Democrat talking point that bribery was invoked here. Ambassador Volker denied that there was a quid pro quo, and Mr. Morrison said there was nothing wrong on the call. The only direct evidence came from Gordon Sondland, who spoke to the President of the United States, and the President said, I want nothing. No quid pro quo. And you know what? If wiretapping a political opponent's an impeachable offense, I look forward to reading that Inspector General's report, because maybe it's a different president we should be impeaching.
Gentlemen's time has expired, Mr. Cicilline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Feldman, let me begin by stating the obvious. It is not hearsay when the president tells the president of Ukraine to investigate his political adversary, is it?
It is not.
It is not hearsay when the president then confesses on national television to doing that, is it?
It is not.
It is not hearsay when administration officials testify that they hear the president say he only cares about the investigations of his political opponent. Is it?
No, that is not hearsay.
And there's lots of other direct evidence in this 300-page report from the Intelligence Committee, so let's dispense with that claim by my Republican colleagues. Professor Garrity, Professor Turley, notwithstanding what he said today, wrote on August 1st, 2014, in a piece called Five Myths About Impeachment. One of the myths he was rejecting was that impeachment required a criminal offense. And he wrote, and I quote, "An offense does not have to be indictable. Serious misconduct or a violation of public trust is enough," end quote. Was Professor Turley right when he wrote that back in 2014?
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay. Now, next, I'm going to move to Professor Carlin. At the Constitutional Convention, Elbridge Gerry said, and I quote, "Foreign powers will intermeddle in our affairs and spare no expense to influence them." And in response, James Madison said that impeachment was needed because otherwise a president, and I quote, "might betray his trust to a foreign power." Professor Carlin, can you elaborate on why the framers were so concerned about foreign interference, how they accounted for these concerns, and how that relates to the facts before this committee?
So the reason that the framers were concerned about foreign interference, I think, is slightly different than the reason we are. They were concerned about it because we were such a weak country in 1789. We were small, we were poor, we didn't have an established navy, we didn't have an established army. Today the concern is a little different, which is that it will interfere with us making the decisions that are best for us as Americans.
Thank you, Professor. There are three known instances of the president publicly asking a foreign country to interfere in our elections. First, in 2016, the president publicly hoped that Russia would hack into the email of a political opponent, which they subsequently did. Second, based on the president's own summary of his call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, we know he asked Ukraine to announce an investigation of his chief political rival and used aid appropriated by Congress as leverage in his efforts to achieve this. And third, the president then publicly urged China to begin its own investigation. Professor Feldman, how would it impact our democracy if it became standard practice for the President of the United States to ask a foreign government to interfere in our elections?
It would be a disaster for the functioning of our democracy if our presidents regularly, as this president has done, asked foreign governments to interfere in our electoral process.
I'd like to end with a powerful warning from George Washington, who told Americans in his farewell address, and I quote, to be constantly awake, since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of Republican government, end quote. The conduct at issue here is egregious and warrants a commensurate response. The president has openly and repeatedly solicited foreign interference in our elections. Of that, there is no doubt. This matters because inviting foreign meddling into our elections robs the American people of their sacred right to elect their own political leaders. Americans all across this country wait in long lines to exercise their right to vote and to choose their own leaders. This right does not belong to foreign governments. We fought and won a revolution over this. Free and fair elections are what separate us from authoritarians all over the world. As public servants and members of the House, we would be negligent in our duties under the Constitution if we let this blatant abuse of power go unchecked. We've heard a lot about hating this president. It's not about hating this president. It's about our love of country. It's about honoring the oath that we took to protect and defend the Constitution of this great country. And so my final question is to Professor Feldman and to Professor Carlin, in the face of this evidence, what are the consequences if this committee and this Congress refuses to muster the courage to respond to this gross abuse of power that undermined the national security of the United States, that undermined the integrity of our elections, and that undermined the confidence that we have to have in the president to not abuse the power of his office?
If this committee and this House fail to act, then you're sending a message to this president and to future presidents that it's no longer a problem if they abuse their power, it's no longer a problem if they invite other countries to interfere in our elections, and it's no longer a problem if they put the interests of other countries ahead of ours.
Professor Carlin?
I agree with Professor Feldman, and I should say just one thing, and I apologize for getting a little overheated a moment ago, but I have a constitutional right under the First Amendment to give money to candidates. At the same time, we have a constitutional duty to keep foreigners from spending money in our elections, and those two things are two sides of the same coin.
Thank you, and with that, I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman yields back. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. I was struck this morning by the same thing as all my friends and colleagues on this side of the room. Chairman Nadler actually began this morning with the outrageous statement that the facts before us are undisputed. Of course, everyone here knows that that's simply not true. Every person here, every person watching at home knows full well that virtually everything here is disputed, from the fraudulent process and the broken procedure to the Democrats' unfounded claims. And the full facts are obviously not before us today. We've been allowed no fact witnesses here at all. For the first time ever, this committee, which is the one in Congress that has the actual jurisdiction over impeachment, is being given no access to the underlying evidence that Adam Schiff and his political accomplices claim supports this whole charade. This is just a shocking denial of due process. And I want to say to our witnesses, I'm also a constitutional law attorney, and under normal circumstances, I really would greatly enjoy an academic discussion with you, a debate about the contours of Article 2, Section 4. But that would be an utter waste of our time today, because as has been highlighted so many times this morning, this whole production is a sham and a reckless path to a predetermined political outcome. And I want you to know it's an outcome that was predetermined by our Democrat colleagues a long time ago. The truth is, House Democrats have been working to impeach President Donald J. Trump since the day he took his oath of office. Over the past 3 years, they've introduced four different resolutions seeking to impeach the president. Almost exactly 2 years ago, as one of the graphics up here shows, December 6, 2017, 58 House Democrats voted to begin impeachment proceedings. Of course, that was almost 20 months before the famous July 25th phone call with Ukraine's President Zelensky. And this other graphic up here is smaller, but it's interesting, too. I think it's important to reiterate for everybody watching at home that of our 24 Democrat colleagues and friends on the other side of the room today, 17 out of 24 have already voted for impeachment. So, I mean, let's be honest. Let's not pretend that anybody cares anything about what's being said here today or the actual evidence or the facts. As Congresswoman Loftgren said, we come with open minds. That's not happening here. So much for an impartial jury. Several times this year, leading Democrats have frankly admitted in various interviews and correspondence that they really believe this entire strategy is necessary because, why? Because they want to stop the president's reelection. Even Speaker Pelosi said famously last month that, quote, it is dangerous to allow the American people to evaluate his performance at the ballot box. Speaker Pelosi has it exactly backwards. What is dangerous here is the precedent all this is setting for the future of our republic. I love what Professor Turley testified to this morning. He said, this is simply not how the impeachment of a president is done. His rhetorical question to all of our colleagues on the other side is still echoing throughout this chamber. He asked you to ask yourselves, where will this and where will you stand next time when this same kind of sham impeachment process is initiated against a president from your party? The real shame here today is that everything in Washington has become bitterly partisan, and this ugly chapter is not going to help that. It's going to make things really that much worse. President Turley said earlier that we are now living in the era that was feared by our founders, what Hamilton referred to as a period of agitated passions. I think that says it so well. This has indeed become an age of rage. President Washington warned in his farewell address in 1796 that extreme partisanship would lead us to the ruins of public liberty. Those were his words. This hyper-partisan impeachment is probably one of the most divisive and destructive things that we could possibly do to our American family. Let me tell you what I heard from my constituents in multiple town halls and meetings back in my district just 2 days ago. The people of this country are sick of this. They're sick of the politics of personal destruction. They're sick of this toxic atmosphere that is being created here. And they're deeply concerned about where all this will lead us in the years ahead, rightfully so. You know what the greatest threat is? The thing that ought to keep every single one of us up at night is the rapidly eroding trust of the American people in their institutions. One of the critical presuppositions and foundations of a self-governing people in a constitutional republic is that they will maintain a basic level of trust in their institutions, in the rule of law, in the system of justice, in the body of elected representatives, their citizen legislators, in the Congress. The greatest danger of this fraudulent impeachment production is not what happens this afternoon or by Christmas or in the election next fall. The greatest danger is what this will do in the days ahead to our 243-year experiment in self-governance. What effect this foolish new precedent, this Pandora's box, will have upon our beleaguered nation 6 or 7 years from now, a decade from now, in the ruins of public liberty that are being created by this terribly short-sighted exercise today. God help us. I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. Mr. Swallow.
Professor Turley is a former prosecutor. I recognize a defense attorney trying to represent their client, especially one who has very little to work with in the way of facts. And today, you're representing the Republicans in their defense of the president. Professor,
you've
said that this case represents a dramatic turning point in federal impeachment precedent, the impact of which will shape and determine future cases. The House, for the first time in the modern era, asked the Senate to remove someone for conduct for which he was never charged criminally and the impropriety of which has never been tested in a court of law. But that's actually not a direct quote from what you said today. It sounds a lot like what you've argued today, but that's a quote from what you argued as a defense lawyer in a 2010 Senate impeachment trial. Professor, did you represent federal judge Thomas Porteous?
I did indeed.
And Judge Porteous was tried on 4 articles of impeachment, ranging from engaging in a pattern of conduct that is incompatible with the trust and confidence placed in him as a federal judge, to engaging in a longstanding pattern of corrupt conduct that demonstrates his unfitness to serve as a United States District Court judge. On each count, Judge Porteous was convicted by at least 68 and up to 96 bipartisan senators. Thankfully, that Senate did not buy your argument that a federal official should not be removed if he is not charged criminally. And respectfully, Professor, we don't buy it either. But we're here because of this photo. It's a picture of President Zelensky in May of this year standing on the eastern front of Ukraine as a hot war was taking place and up to 15,000 Ukrainians have died at the hands of Russians. I'd like to focus on the impact of President Trump's conduct, particularly with our allies and our standing in the world. This isn't just a president, as Professor Carlin has pointed out, asking for another foreign leader to investigate a political opponent. It also is a president leveraging a White House visit as well as foreign aid. As the witnesses have testified, Ukraine needs our support to defend itself against Russia. I heard directly from witnesses how important the visit and the aid were, particularly from Ambassador Taylor.
These weapons weapons, and this assistance, it allows the Ukrainian military to deter further incursions by the Russians against their own, against Ukrainian territory. If that further incursion, further aggression, were to take place, more Ukrainians would die.
Professor Carlin, does the president's decision to withhold from Ukraine such important official acts, a White House visit and military aid, in order to pressure President Zelensky, relate to the framers' concerns about abuse of power and entanglements with foreign nations?
It relates to the abuse of power. The entanglements with foreign nations is a more complicated concept for the framers than for us.
And Professor Carlin, I think you'd agree we are a nation of immigrants.
Yes.
Today, 50 million immigrants live in the United States. I'm moved by one who recently told me as I was checking into a hotel about his Romanian family. He came here from Romania and said that every time he had gone home for the last 20 years, he would always tell his family members how corrupt his country was, that he had left, and why he had come to the United States. And he told me in such humiliating fashion that when he has gone home recently, they now wag their finger at him and say, "You're going to lecture us about corruption?" What do you think, Professor Carlin, does the president's conduct say to the millions of Americans who left their families and livelihoods to come to a country that represents the rule of law?
I think it suggests that we don't believe in the rule of law, and I think it tells emerging democracies around the world not to take it seriously when we tell them that their elections are not legitimate because of foreign interference, or their elections are not legitimate because of persecution of the opposing party. I mean, President Bush announced that he did not consider the elections in Belarus in 2006 to be legitimate for exactly that reason, because they went after political opponents.
Thank you. Finally, Professor Feldman, Professor Turley has pointed out that we should wait and that we should go to the courts, but you would acknowledge that we've gone to the courts. We've been in the courts for over 6 months, many times, on matters that are already settled in the United States Supreme Court, particularly U.S. v. Nixon, where the president seems to be running out the clock. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, and I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. We will, in a moment, we will recess for a brief 5 minutes. First, I ask everyone in the room to please remain seated and quiet while the witnesses exit the room. I also want to remind those in the audience that you may not be guaranteed your seat if you leave the hearing room at this time. Stand in a short recess.